Transmitiendo desde San Ildefonso número 28, antigua escuela de jurisprudencia, grado cero de la enseñanza del derecho en México, esto es Procrastinando, un programa de filosofía del derecho con un carácter meramente informal. I'm so happy, 'cause today found my friends in my head. I'm so ugly, that's okay, 'cause so are you. Book on me is Sunday morning, is every day for all I care. And I'm not scared, light my candles in our days, 'cause I found God. Yeah!
Welcome, Dr. Susan Bookmores. First of all, it's a pleasure to have you here on the program.
Thank you.
We must confess that we are real admirers of your work. We have been talking, a few months ago we talked with Martin Jay, also about the Critical School of Frankfurt, and now talking with you about the same subject and your work is a real honor for us.
Thank you.
The first question that I have for you is, what is the... for you, what is critical theory, and what is the actuality of the critical theory?
The actuality today.
Yeah.
Okay, so critical theory itself, the whole notion of critique really has to be traced back to Kant, who taught us to reflect on thinking itself. And if you take a wonderful phrase by Fichte, it was to his audience, "Gentlemen, think the wall. Now think the person who thinks the wall." In other words, who is this subject that thinks? Can we reflect on thinking itself? That's the critical gesture. And so critical theory is still true to that original German idealist tradition, or I shouldn't call it idealist because Kant would have said, no, I'm not an idealist. But it goes to that moment, but then it is post-Marx, so it understands the thinking subject as itself in an objective milieu, that is, in a particular society at a particular time in history with a particular economic structure, and therefore that objective milieu reflects in the subject who reflects. But not in a circle, in a way that gives some space in between these. In other words, I can reflect critically on my milieu, on my context, my social context, my economic context. So it's that critical gesture of reflection, understanding that it's not just I'm thinking something, but what is it to think something in a certain way? That question is crucial for me as the meaning of critical theory.
Today, one of the big influences on your thinking is Theodore Adorno and Walter Benjamin.
Yeah.
Some critics have said that Adorno doesn't respect dialectics, the Hegelian dialectics.
Yes.
What do you think about this?
No, absolutely, he rejected. He feels that Hegel actually is perhaps the greatest philosopher. He has an enormous respect for Hegel, but what he sees happening is that the Hegelian dialectic became a legitimation for whatever happens in history. And he would Adorno therefore took a distance from ever affirming some development in history itself. He felt thought always had to think against reality, could never say, okay, having thought against reality, I now reconcile myself with reality. For Adorno, that would have been impossible. Incidentally, Benjamin is not really a critical theorist in this context. He goes his own way. He's connected with the Frankfurt School for obvious historical reasons. But I teach a course on critical reason, and I don't teach Benjamin in that course. I don't do that, because what he's up to is something quite different. But for Adorno, he's very comfortable within that tradition.
People say that apply the Adorno's dialectics most because of your work, Negative Dialectics. People say that applied Adorno's dialectics is too hard, and maybe it's impossible.
Yes, I agree. I actually agree. When I was working on that book, which also talks about the debates between him and Walter Benjamin, I found myself always attracted to Benjamin's side of the argument. To think in as a negative thought all the time is extremely difficult. It produces a kind of language that is very, very difficult to follow. And I think that it is ultimately unsuccessful. I can't say that Adorno influences my thinking anywhere near the degree to which Benjamin influences my thought.
You wrote a book about Benjamin, named...
La Dialectica della Mirada.
No, the other one. The one of the late... Dialectica de la Mirada. Yes,
that's it.
In that book, there is an essay that is named Aesthetic and Anesthetics.
Oh, yes. Oh, no, that's another book, but you're right. Aesthetics and Anesthetics, yes.
Yes. What do you mean when you talk about aesthetics and anesthetics?
So, aesthetics originally does not mean art. Aesthetikos in ancient Greek means simply perceptive through feeling. It's preconceptual. It doesn't mean art objects. It simply means to sense something, to intuit it, to know it through your senses, right? And what seems to have happened in contemporary mass society, at least this was felt by Adorno, who was very critical of mass culture, is that the sensory perception had actually been transformed into an anesthetic. It was no longer an aesthetic, but an anesthetic. And Benjamin also could see that that had happened in ways that had tricked the masses into support enthusiasm for Hitler and for fascism.
In this essay, also you work that capitalism lost has something to do with the problem of aesthetics and anesthetics.
Yes, I do. Can you remind me what I said in that regard?
Yes, capitalism tried to make us lose the kind of aesthetics and...
Yes, I don't know if I would have said capitalism. I think I would have been more... okay, maybe commodity society, maybe the reification of that goes along with falling in love with objects as opposed to having a more human interaction. Capitalism perhaps, but I think that a lot of these problems were not unique to capitalism. They were problems in the Soviet Union as well, and of course Adorno very, very explicitly would have critiqued communism with the same argument against mass culture that he critiqued capitalism. Benjamin kept hoping in the 1930s for an interpretation of socialism which would be very different from the Stalinist one and actually would enable some hope in a socialist revolution, a proletariat revolution, whereas Adorno was really, you have to say, became extremely pessimistic and remained pessimistic for all of his life.
I read an interview that people made to you, and in this interview you say that in the book Dialectics of Enlightenment,
yes,
they may not talk about capital in the way that is an antagonist social form.
Yes.
Jorge Jaime and Adorno didn't try to talk about that. Can you explain that idea?
You're talking about a book that I wrote as my senior thesis, or my PhD, quite a few years ago. So if I recall correctly, it would simply be, here's what happened as far as Adorno is concerned. And he spent time in the United States. You know, he lived in Hollywood or outside of Hollywood in Brentwood in Los Angeles. And so he saw mass culture American style. And he knew mass culture fascist style. And he knew Stalinist propaganda. And he really rejected across the board all of these ways that he felt made the masses stupid. Now, he was accused, of course, of elitism in the process. But to blame... So what I'm saying is, for Adorno, when he criticizes Auschwitz, he says always at the same time, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right? And also the Stalinist trials, the show trials of the 1930s. So he would have put all three of those together. Therefore, it's not a critique that remains focused on capitalism, not for Adorno.
Yeah. You have a, talking about capitalism and the interpretation of some authors, you wrote a book, a really interesting book, named Hegel and ID.
Yes.
Why apply the Hegelian theory to Caribbean countries?
No, well, this is something different.
Colonialism.
It is not applying the theory to colonial countries, not at all. What happened was a kind of awareness that I had in the early 1990s that Hegel was writing the Phenomenology of Mind at the very same moment that the Haitian Revolution was drawing to a close, that he was lecturing on what became the Phenomenology beginning in 1803, 1804, 1805. These were the years of Dessalines and the completion of the Haitian Revolution, which begins with Toussaint Louverture, of course, and with a kind of Declaration of the Rights of Man, and with a new constitution and a lot of influence from France, okay? So I thought to myself, this is strange. These two things happened at the same time in history. So was there a connection? And I would ask the experts, and they'd say, no, no connection. Yes, Hegel talks about slavery, but he means Spartacus in ancient Greece. But it struck me as very strange, because in the Phenomenology, Hegel talks about the economy, and he means Adam Smith's description of capitalism, the early mercantile capitalism, or the market, yes. When he talks about politics, he means the French Revolution, even if he doesn't name it, he means the French Revolution. But then suddenly when he talks about slavery, he's supposed to be talking about Spartacus and ancient Rome. It didn't make sense to me. But I was not an expert, and so I was quiet for 10 years. And then I found, and I looked, and then I found this journal called Minerva, which of course is a word very important for Hegel, and it was the most important political review in all of in all of Europe, and it was done in German, but it borrowed freely from English sources, particularly because the French under Napoleon were at war. Of course, the Napoleonic Wars were going on, and in that journal, precisely in 1803, 1804, 1805, there were hundreds of pages written, a retrospective of 10 years, history of the Haitian Revolution. And we know for a fact that Hegel read that journal. So he knew about the Haitian Revolution. And he had to have known that when he talked about the dialectic of master and slave, that people who read it, just as they would understand when he was talking about heads rolling like cabbages, he was talking about the French guillotine, he would have had to know that they saw, he's talking about Haiti. And precisely because the Haitians, who are different, for him, race, they're African, whatever, different culture, could be inspired by the spirit of the French Revolution, was proof of its universality. So that was my argument, and it's really made quite, yeah, it's made, people are on two sides on that. Some, you know, and a lot of the Hegel scholars still do not accept it, or say, okay, I don't care if he knew about Haiti, it doesn't change anything. But it does, of course.
In your book about, in Dialectica de la Mirada, book, you talk about Benjamin and the Book of Passages.
Yes.
And Benjamin once said that the history progress in a state of exceptions. But I don't think you believe that part. You don't think that grows in a state of exception, the history?
Well, no, he says, in the thesis, he says that what we are forgetting when we think, oh my gosh, look at this horrible situation, this emergency situation today, it's amazing that it could happen. He says, no, it's not amazing. It's always been like this. So it's not as if it's a theory of stages of history as states of exception, but that history has always been a bloodbath, always had victims and always been exploitative of workers, always. So,
and always will be?
No. Every generation has a weak messianic power to change the situation, but only the living have that power. All of us alive today. If we do what we did this morning, tomorrow morning, the world will stay the way it is. And if we don't, then there's a possibility of something happening.
In your work as a professor, you apply a singular method, that is really interesting to me. I also saw it in your conference, in your first conference. I don't know if you're going to do the same here, in which you apply visual images.
Yes.
As a living methodology.
Yes.
What do you mean that visual image is a living methodology?
For me, images are crucial. I take it literally from Benjamin, who talks about images. I make it literal. I mean, and an image for me is not a picture. It may be an art, you know, an image of art. It may be a photograph. It could be anything, but it's an image. Benjamin wrote, only images in the mind motivate the will. So images for me are a way of intensifying the effect of a thought. And indeed, my philosophical position is that sense perception, including an image, precedes a conceptual understanding. So we start with the image, and we can think in images before we actually control the thought in a clearly systematic conceptual way.
In a late interview that people make to you, and I don't know the press media that made this interview to you, you say that you are now attracted by the anarchist thought, because it's kind of a powerful form of ideas. Do you still feel the same?
I'm not quite sure what that refers to, so I can't, but I will respond to the question of anarchism or the issue of anarchism. Not anarchism, I don't like any isms, right? But let's say anarchist. Let's say that the approach to politics today that doesn't see all politics as necessarily being channeled through political parties, elections, nation states, etc. And a more anarchic way of doing politics. I would support that. But anarchic means simply not about seizing state power, that our way of producing political action occurs in civil society, occurs at the level of citizens occupying public space, citizens changing the ways they relate to each other. So if that's what you mean by anarchism,
yes,
then I embrace the term.
And one last question, because we know that you have a conference to do,
yes,
to make in a few minutes. You, in one write, you in essay you wrote, you say that the postmodern is a dead end.
Yes.
So what is the answer?
Yeah, okay, what comes there? I think postmodernism, it's a coward's word, right? We had modernism, we know it's over, but we don't know it's coming, so we talk about postmodernism or post-Marxism or post-secularism, these words. So I actually think that globalization is not a space, but a time. It's a new era, and it's one that puts us all in the same political time zone. That's an idea that I have, that there's no one who's forward or advanced, and then others are behind. Everyone's in the same global reality, and we occupy the same political time zone. So this has implications that may also be anarchist, but it does mean that the new technologies matter. The technologies that we only are just beginning to understand the power of, right? And I'm talking, of course, about social media. I'm talking about the internet. I'm talking about Wikipedia methods of producing knowledge, which is collective and quite responsible, right? So all of this seems to me to be taking shape at the beginning of the 21st century. We're in a new century. We're almost far enough into that century to begin to define what it consists of, right? And I think that globalization is the word that describes a temporal difference, right? from the internationalism, let's say, of World War I, World War II, right? They were times of national, international conflict, international control, government control by nation states and their imperial domains. But now we're in a different situation where nation states are not going to be considered the major actors. I don't think so. I mean, look how impotent nation states are to solve the situation in Syria or in Kiev. It's very telling how this capacity of Obama, for instance, to make a difference when I just heard that he spoke in Mexico about Kiev, for instance. I mean, it doesn't seem that leaders of nation states really can control the outcome of international events, and that more powerful actors are the people on the streets.
I have to make these last questions. Yes. If not, I will feel regret. For you that are a real quite prestigious philosopher, and you have worked in the philosophy of history, what is history?
Oh, that is the toughest one, actually. That's very hard. That's very hard. Okay, I'm going to answer kind of cryptically and say that history is the is a necessary residue of theology within modernity. History is the claim that human events matter, that they have some meaning. And that's a theological claim. So in our time, when we are secular thinkers, right, and I'm talking now about modernity, we look to explain historical events, explain events by looking at their history. What caused them to evolve historically? That is our answer to the question of how the world is the way it is. What is the meaning of things? How do things evolve the way they do? History is a huge question because history is not an object. I couldn't tell you to go out and bring me back history. You can't find it, right? So it's a very strange, obscure term. And the more I think about it, the more obscure it becomes.
Well, Dr. Susan Buchmors, has been a real honor to interview you, and I have with you a few minutes. It's really an honor.
Well, it's an honor be interviewed by you and to find out that you've read so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I'm so lonely, that's okay, shake my head, and I'm not sad, and just maybe I'm too blind.